Apple Card is a different kind of cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply. Welcome to Navel Gazing. I'm John Dickerson. We start this second episode of season one, as we have every episode in this podcast's long history, with a written notebook entry. Notebook 75, page 6, September 2021. They chose you. This entry greeted me when I opened my Field Notes notebook on the living room Sunday that was the topic of the first episode of this podcast. I didn't notice this entry on that Sunday because I was busy trying to write down what Anne had said, literally, about the dog and our son, and hoping that in so doing, something would occur to me in the writing. I'd excavate meaning. Another thought would present, and I could put a glass around the cocktail of feelings we were having. Or failing that, I hoped I would capture the words accurately for later consideration. So what does this entry mean, though? They chose you. Well, I'm not quoting anyone, as I was in our first entry. These words were the epicenter of a pep talk I wanted to give my oldest child before leaving him at college, to the chill of his cinder block cell and the contusions of new acquaintance. I can't remember where I was when I wrote the entry, but as I read it now, several years later, memory smudges. Time and place get linked in ways I know are totally wrong. I associate the entry, probably written in haste in the middle of a bouncing taxicab, with a fixed location that is not the taxicab. I associate the words, the message, the feeling with the restaurant where we had our last meal with our son before we left him to his adventure. That wasn't where I wrote it. Rather, it was the moment I intended to deploy it. This is how memory works, I suppose. But I'm not usually so conscious of its collage-like nature as I am right now telling this story. I am making something new now, not something recalled. It's not exactly the fact imagined, but an act of fiction propelled by a fact. Memory as a branch of the imagination. In the end, whatever it is that this notation, they chose you, has sparked right now, maybe more true than a transcript of the exact thoughts I had in the bouncy taxicab the moment I made the notation. So I'm going to travel us to that lunch. This I know is true. The restaurant for this meal, where we had our last bite before heading home, had neon script on a blue wall. Like a black light poster, neon is an idea that seems like a good one right up to the moment you execute it. You plant the nail, settle the tubes, and the minute your hands are free, you're using them to search Google. How do you safely dispose of neon? We ordered fried chicken sandwiches at lunch. The waitress made a big deal about the fried chicken sandwiches. And when they arrived, they still seemed to be in the process of happening. The steroidal chicken dominated the hopeless bun, which was already down on one knee, having been pressure washed into submission with jets of special sauce. By the time you were done eating the wreckage, you felt like you were mostly wearing it. So the food was against us, which added to the turbulence of this leave-taking moment where everything felt like it was slipping off the bun and I was trying not to add too much sauce. The moment had been in my subconscious for a long time, hence the notation. Now that this moment had arrived, I was looking to deploy, in a low-key way, some reassuring advice. But every thought I had seemed too grandiose. Neither a borrower nor a lender be. Plastic son. What I wanted to do with some parting advice was to try to head off grand conclusions. If my son was like me, there was the chance that the natural lonesomeness of a new school could lead him to conclude that he didn't belong. In other words, that imposter syndrome might be genetic. When you have those kinds of thoughts, one response is to draw grand conclusions. Doing so, being declarative, assures you that you are not powerless. You're exercising your agency, taking action by pushing the new place away. The danger, though, is that while you might rescue yourself from temporary discomfort in a moment of transition by rejecting your new circumstances, the move comes at the cost of becoming yourself, which can only happen by passing through those moments of discomfort, not pushing them away. And since adulthood is spent ping-ponging between new experiences, or it should be anyway, I wanted to say something helpful for this first extended solo experience with fitting in when nothing seems to fit. A piece of advice that has nourished me over the years came from my former colleague at Time magazine, Karen Tumulty. She's now an opinion writer at the Washington Post. When I entered the Washington Bureau of Time magazine in 1995, she said, "Make no judgments about a new place for 18 months. She had standing to make this argument because she'd just come from the Los Angeles Times. I don't know if that's the correct number of months. It feels a little long, but the advice gave me permission to delay drawing large conclusions. Or more precisely, it made me suspicious of the grand conclusions my fevered brain was drawing, most of which were dire. Reserving judgment was hard to do at Time magazine in the mid-90s because at that time, the magazine's role in the news world was to draw grand conclusions. Stories started with a small moment into which we would stuff universal significance about enormous changes in American life and politics. It was the era of the great theatrical lead, where you rolled in a full orchestra to start off stories. In the early dawn, Mr. Frederick Johnson, like countless Americans, partakes in the quintessential weekend chore of lawn grooming, a vestige of the American dream. Yet as he maneuvers his mower across the suburban expanse, Johnson's regard for his democratic ideal is as ephemeral as the clippings he casually brushes from his dungarees. These kinds of sweeping scenes are less common now because the internet took away everybody's patience. You've got to get right to the action immediately in stories now. No shuffling around with theatrics. However, this training cannot be shaken from my bones. You might notice the remnants of this Time magazine technique in the Sunday afternoon living room declaration that kicked off episode one. Karen Tumulty's wisdom about waiting 18 months has been formalized into a decision-making system I once read about. Here's what you're supposed to do. When you enter a new situation, write down your expectations, what you think the likely outcomes will be over the next year. Put this material in an envelope, tie it with a bow if you'd like, put it aside. In a year, look at what you've written. You'll usually find that you worried about a lot of stuff that didn't come to pass. Dragons, whooping cough, hammer toe. The distance between what you expected and what took place will be so large, it will cure you of making such grand claims the next time you encounter a new experience. Or it will at least keep you from worrying so much in the next moment of transition. I think of this system as learned stoicism. The Stoics say, don't borrow worry. Fine, great, Marcus, I really appreciate it. But some people need proof to back up these aphorisms, and this system gives you proof as you encounter life's repeated new challenges that maybe your worry is often misplaced. Before the lunch of insistent chicken, we had been seen to by college dorm greeters. College admissions authorities anticipate more or less this fear of fitting in, and to make new students feel welcome, they launch peppy flotillas of sophomores at new arrivals in the parking lot outside the freshman dorm. The enlisted advance at you in school colors, teeth white as picked bones, reaching out for suitcase handles and insisting that the ice cream social is really going to be great. It is exactly the same vibe as the wedding band singer calling everyone to the parquet floor to celebrate good times tonight. Come on. In our case, the startling teeth and cheer had not calmed things. It might have made things worse. I was not comfortable in new environments when I was younger, and now that I'm older, I am also not comfortable in new environments. This is why I smoked in college. Smoking gave me something to do upon entering a room full of people, seemingly to so effortlessly engage in human commerce. I could smoke while I tried to figure out where to fit in or how to make my escape if I decided that I didn't. We all have phones for this diversionary purpose now. The cigarette was useful back then because it worked both in solitary contemplation as well as in group settings. Hipsters around a bar table with varying lengths of ash looked like at any moment any one of them might produce a volume of poetry. If you were standing alone smoking a cigarette, it didn't mean you were a loser. it meant you might very well be reframing our narrow view of the Bronze Age. The smartphone lacks this dual purpose. It alleviates the awkward aloneness, but when we are together, it can make us all feel alone. The image of a ring of vacant eyes following illuminated screens in a circle at a bar does not invite the new entrant into the circle. It invites sorrow. A notebook is a worthy device in these circumstances, too, I might add. Fish a notebook from your back pocket when you're standing alone in the corner, and people will think you are onto something big as you write. They don't have to know that the notebook entry you're writing may very well read, "I'm standing here writing to occupy myself while I try to get my bearings."
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection, to the opening arguments, to the witness testimony and cross-examination, and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
This episode is brought to you by Audible, the destination for thrilling audio entertainment. With highly anticipated new releases and top-tier recommendations, Audible is here for every type of thriller listener. I'm a thriller listener because Ruth Marcus, friend of the Gabfest, on the Gabfest, said she had been listening to a ton of French's novels, a thriller, and so I thought, oh, I want to check that out. So I listened to it on Audible. It's called In the Woods, and it is it's a fantastic story. I can't give it away, but it's this multi-generational mystery. It takes place in Ireland. And then I started listening to more thrillers, basically working my way through Raymond Chandler, because it's this great thing when you want to totally escape. And so it's this wonderful way to disappear in the middle of the day when I take my after-lunch walk by listening to a thriller. And of course, I should mention, oh my gosh, the Sherlock Holmes stories, which have been a staple in our Audible library. Audible members can keep one title a month from the entire catalog. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/navelgazing or text navelgazing to 500-500. audible.com/navelgazing or text navelgazing to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. The time has long passed for this entry to achieve its intended purpose in 2021. That is, of reminding me about the core of the message I wanted to convey at the goodbye lunch. That message, they chose you. But it's doing good work for us here in 2024 as I look at the yellow-covered field notes in the attic where I sit and stir this pot of recollections. It affirms the experiment that by slowing down, looking at these notes from a life, that there is value. The value that comes from consideration in a world of assaults on our attention, where we are robbed of even a moment to consider. Let me unfold some of the things I've realized. My first realization is that I'm not very good at looking back at the notebooks where I have written prompts to remind me about actions I should take in the future. I never look back on this entry in the time frame where it would have been useful. At this point, so many years later, the son of these recollections is a junior. He's giving me advice now, a topic for a later episode. It's possible that I didn't need to look at this notation. Then maybe once I wrote down they chose you, I had implanted the idea in a way that that was all I needed, and I carried that sentiment with me in my head, and I didn't actually need to look when I was at lunch that day or standing outside before we entered the restaurant. There's an entire theory of pedagogy around this. The act of writing something down implants it in your head. This is why they're teaching handwriting in the public schools of California again after doing away with it many years ago. I also realize on this later pass that they chose you contains a sentiment Anne's parents conveyed when they told her she was adopted. She wasn't given up by a mother and a father, they told her, but chosen by a family. They'd been trying to assure her that she belonged, that she fit in. They chose you. I was referring to the college selection committee, but the message is at the heart of parenting, repeatedly sending the message in one form or another to your kids that they belong. No matter where they are surrounded by your love. Feeling loved, the beginning of belonging for all of us. My next discovery, looking at this notebook in the attic above the sirens and the honking of New York City, is that this passage is a marker. Or more precisely, that the lunch, which I have now associated with this passage in the notebook, is a marker. It's a marker of the start of a great period of adulthood in our eldest child's life, and the marker of the stark end of a period of time for us, his parents. He had spent the majority of his days in a year living with us. But after I paid the lunch bill, and either did or didn't give this piece of glittering parenting advice in the notebook entry, he would never spend the majority of his days in a year living with us again. I've always thought our job as parents was to teach our kids how to leave us. I have no idea if we did that. But I thought there would be more time, or that the opportunities for the transfer of knowledge would be more clear. Nope, time's up. Put down your pencils. Pre-order your walkers and pill cases to get big savings. But hold on. There is a bigger marker that comes to me in later consideration of this moment. This would be the fourth revelation from this notebook entry if you're marking them on your navel-gazing revelation tracker home notepad. The marker is as obvious as if the city fathers had commemorated it on a brass plaque ordered from that awards and trophy store out by the airport. Parenting's end! On this spot, did John Dickerson try to sneak past the goalie one last piece of parenting advice? I wasn't giving my son advice at all at this lunch. I mean, of course, that's what I thought I was doing back then. But now I realize that mostly what I was doing was talking to myself. Let's review what we've been talking about. The natural thing to do when going through a moment of transition is to rely on the old familiar moves to make us feel comfortable. Light a cigarette, pull out a notebook or a phone, it gives us control. That's what physical tics are, right? The movements, utterances that settle us down and make us feel like we are ourselves, even in foreign climes. What more familiar go-to move is there for a parent than to give advice? It is the unit of measurement of parenting, advice giving. I mean, I suppose I could have brought out the baseball gloves and called for a quick game of catch to engage in activity that would assert the traditional parent-child bond, but that wasn't realistic. There were other diners. Plus, we might break the neon. And that's not an approved method for disposing of it, according to Google. Let's run down the list of why advice is the go-to move for a parent in turbulence. A, we do it a lot as parents. It's a comfortable pose. And B, implicit in advice is control. Only a person of command gives advice. By giving advice, you deny for a moment that you are an unspooling bundle of emotions causing fellow diners at lunch to eye the defibrillation machine. I thought I was going to assist my son as he tried to navigate this new turbulence, but the desire to do so is more fully seen as a demonstration of my effort to manage my own wobble and the wobble to come. When you leave home for college or your first experience out on your own, it's the first time you learn to really adapt and find your voice, which I'd always thought was like a one-time thing, or a single skill that you built on. But actually, I think when you leave home, it's the first time you do that voice finding in a life full of finding new voices when faced with new circumstances, reframing and resetting with each transition. Realizing over and over that, as executive coach Marshall Goldsmith says in his famous book of the same title, that what got you here won't get you there. The songwriter, Nick Cave, arrives to this moment as if he were there with us under the neon. Here's what he writes. We're often led to believe that getting older is in itself somehow a betrayal of our idealistic younger self. But sometimes I think it might be the other way around. Maybe the younger self finds it difficult to inhabit its true potential because it has no idea what that potential is. It is a kind of unformed thing running scared most of the time, frantically trying to build its sense of self. This is me! Here I am! In any way that it can. But then time and life come along and smash that sense of self into a million pieces. This smashing that Nick Cave is talking about is the prelude to building back a durable sense of yourself. Life keeps hurling the wrecking ball until whoever you are is forged. Life is always arriving, is how Gabrielle Zevin writes about it in her novel Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. Smashing is no fun. It's hard. It's full of fears and tears and woe. But to mix my blacksmith and seafaring metaphors, great sailors aren't made by easy seas. So in this moment of identity shattering and formation, which goes on our entire lives, no matter which role you're playing at the chicken sandwich place, I'm brought back to this notebook habit I've kept, but about which I'm still mystified. Writing these notes is not just a crutch for managing the first moments inside the door at an unfamiliar space. These notes have been a place to construct that identity, not fully, not completely. Conversation, declarations, novels, journals, peoples, lots more help put it all together. But this process, these notebooks, are the record of that construction of a self, something we all do, but which not everyone annotates. This episode is sponsored by Field Notes brand. Of course, I feel like the entire Navel Gazing podcast and notebook process is sponsored by Field Notes brand, which has been the brand of notebook that I've carried in my back pocket for years and years. The notebook that is the concern of this first season is from their autumn trilogy. They send out for subscribers different designs. You can always get the basic notebook design, but the fantastic artistry of the different subscriptions they send out is one of the many joys of being a Field Notes subscriber. And the one I'm holding in my hand is yellow, connoting autumn. And it's full of annotations that have now been made to it in addition to the original annotations because of this show. And obviously, I have one in my pocket right now. It's from the Foiled Again packet. You can visit fieldnotesbrand.com and save 10% on your first order by using the coupon code GAZING. Now I'd like to try our first act of time travel before ending this episode. Here's a notebook entry that demonstrates what I mean about the notebook's role in identity formation, and which also helps me explain the smashing that was taking place in our lives as parents at that lunch. It's an entry from 2004. This is a new kind of time travel through these notebooks in this podcast, so I'm easing you into it. Later, we'll hop around so much you'll need Dramamine. Notebook 15, page 4, April 2004. Sitting with Bryce by the waterfall, throwing rocks in stream, loading sand from dump truck and loader and back again. That notebook entry is from a visit to my in-laws. There is a creek at the end of their backyard. It has a small bridge you can cross in a few strides. The whole thing looks arranged by a benevolent hobbyist with a model train set in the basement on raised sheets of plywood. A few feet from the bridge is a modest municipal improvement to manage flooding, planned at a zoning meeting, no doubt, executed by good people you went to high school with. The result, a small rushing waterfall. Tailored abandon, rush and chaos. It runs fast enough to change the air on the little beach, where the water falls, a beach that is only big enough for a father and a two-year-old to squat. The air smells like nickels in your mouth. 17 years before the college drop-off, the chicken sandwiches, the neon, the city father's plaque on the wall, I was trying to hold on to something in that moment by the waterfall at the creek. Fix it in time with a pin. I return to this date not as an act of nostalgia. Oh, how our children are grown so quickly and time passes. I mean, sure, but that's not why I've traveled us here. I was trying to capture a feeling by that little creek waterfall in the relatively early period of parenting that marked what it felt like when it was going well. The water in your ears, the loading and the unloading, my son's clarity and uncluttered intent. I was not trying to cover the waterfront, but make a small, tidy point. I was where I was meant to be. I first learned about this idea from David Allen, the productivity guru. His point, which I believe, was that if you were living an ordered life, you could arrange yourself so that whatever task you were doing in that moment, it was exactly the task you were supposed to be doing. I think you can enlarge this into a general principle. In life, if you can ask yourself in any given moment, am I the person I want to be right now? And answer yes to that question, or its variant, am I where I am supposed to be right now? Then you're in pretty good shape, I think. Your actions in that moment are in sync with your values. A good way to live. We'll return to this topic quite a lot in the notebooks, but for the moment, stick with me. This sync can be achieved in many ways. Parenting is one of those ways, but by no means is it the only way. But this entry in the notebook identifies one moment where that was the case. If parenting keeps you in sync or offers opportunities to feel in sync, what happens when you are no longer actively engaged in that effort? You're not just missing your child, you're missing yourself. The closest analogy I have is to when I would spend months on the campaign trail. A campaign gives you focus. You wake up to a different hotel alarm clock every day, but you know your mission. When the campaign ends, you are at home. The alarm clock is the same every morning, but you don't know where to start after it goes off. Expense reports, news stories, the crusted paint cans that have to go to the hazardous waste disposal site, the wiper blade on the Honda that's gone droopy. You lose yourself in the to-do list, where it's difficult to find meaning and purpose. I'd always thought the empty nest discourse was about missing your kids. People warned us about crying fits at the dorm room door. Sure, I love being in their company and I miss it. But I saw that coming. What I didn't see was the disorder, the lack of structure. At any point in the day, the answer to the question, am I the person I want to be right now, is much more up for grabs. The separation I anticipated, I didn't quite anticipate the smashing, the having to rewrite myself. Now we have to figure out where we fit in, Anne and me. We must be our own dorm greeters. I sure hope the ice cream social is going to be as fun as they say. That concludes the second episode of Navel Gazing, or as the French call it, Naval Gazing. Our next episode will return to this notebook from the period of our concern, and the next entry is about our sweet dog, George. Navel Gazing is produced by Shayna Roth. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio at Slate. And our theme music is from the band Plastic Mary. Remember, send us a note at navelgazingpodcast@gmail.com and let us know your thoughts if you are a wild noticer out in the world, a mopey parent, or a note taker or the kin of a note taker. I'd love to hear from you. I'm John Dickerson. Talk to you next week.